for the invitation to Field. It's a great pleasure being here. So this short course about hydrodynamic limits for the Boltzmann equation does not in principle assume anything known on kinetic theory, so I will spend a few minutes at the beginning recalling a few facts about orders of magnitude, what does it mean exactly to be a rarefied gas, and things like this. For those who don't know what it is, it's not focused, or
oh.
All right. So,
that's the only one that counts.
Okay. So, first lecture, I will try to describe formally the simplest of all such hydrodynamic limits of the Boltzmann equation, namely the one that leads from the Boltzmann equation to the compressible Euler equation, the Euler system of gas dynamics. But before that, as I said, let me review a few facts and orders of magnitude and the notion of perfect gas. All right, so we all know that if you take a monatomic gas at room temperature and atmospheric pressure, then in any volume of 1 cubic centimeter, you will find approximately 10 to the 20 gas molecules, right? So that's what the Avogadro number tells you. And these molecules typically would have a radius of 10 to the minus 8 centimeters. And so if you actually think that you're taking all the molecules, that you think of these molecules as little spheres like oranges, and you pack them in one corner of your cubic centimeter, so the packed volume of these spheres, whatever that means, well, it's computed here, and you see that for such molecules with radius 10 to the minus 8 centimeters at usual pressure and temperature condition in this cubic centimeter container, you find that the excluded volume, that is the physical volume occupied by the molecules when you pack them tightly, it's negligible compared to the size of the container, because it's essentially 10 to the minus 4 cubic centimeters. Okay, so it's very small compared to the size of the container. So we're in a situation where the excluded volume, that is the volume occupied by the molecules themselves when tightly packed, is negligible compared to the size of the container. Right. So this is a situation that you abstract by saying that it's a perfect gas. And as you all know, the equation of state for a perfect gas is that the pressure is proportional to the product of the density and the temperature. So here K is Boltzmann's constant, and it's given in units of joule per Kelvin. So it's later on I will very often assume that K is equal to 1. I will choose units accordingly. Okay? So when excluded volume is not negligible, that's when you have corrections to this equation of state for a perfect gas, typically the van der Waals correction, where you would actually take into account excluded volume. So think about this pressure, this equation of state for the pressure, as being a kind of a first order approximation in situations where the excluded volume is negligible. All right, so now there is an important notion for kinetic theory, which is that of mean free path. So it's not very easy to come up with a rigorous definition of a mean free path in mathematical terms, and actually that was a subject of much controversy between Boltzmann, Tate, Maxwell, and other people in the years 1870, actually. So roughly speaking, you want to call the mean free path the average distance between two successive collisions for any given molecule in your gas. And again, think of this gas as being a gas of hard spheres, or, you know, monatomic gas, right? And Of course, the difficulty here is to understand what you mean by average distance. There are several ways of averaging. For one thing, you could take one particle and record on its trajectory the successive collisions and average in time. That's one way of defining the average. It's not the only one, right? And there is some ambiguity in this definition. But intuitively, you will agree that the higher the gas density, the smaller the mean free path, because you get more chance to meet another particle, essentially. Likewise, the bigger the molecules, the smaller the mean free path. And this suggests that the mean free path should be proportional to 1 over the density, the number of gas molecules per unit volume, multiply by the surface area, the section of any individual molecule. So that's certainly one formula, which is homogeneous to your length, right? Because N has a dimension of a reciprocal volume, and A is the surface. So that's homogeneous to your length, and that certainly satisfies this requirement here. In the case of Lorentz gas or Sinai Billiards, you can actually prove rigorously, or you can actually describe rigorously the mean free path in terms of this quantity here, provided that you choose the definition of average in a proper way. Right, so this number here, I don't want to enter into details, but this number here can really be called the mean free path for the Billiard problem, right? So let's work a little bit with this notion of mean free path here. So if we go back to the previous orders of magnitude that we had, so 10 to the 20 molecules per cubic centimeter, molecules of diameter 10 to the minus 8 centimeters. So here you see that in the normal condition of pressure and temperature, that is atmospheric pressure and room temperature, then the mean free path, that definition of the mean free path, will be of the order of 10 to the minus 4 centimeters and will be therefore small compared to the size of the container. Now, that tells you that even though the excluded volume, so the physical volume occupied by the matter, occupied by the molecules, if you pack them in the on one corner of the container, even if this is small, then there is another notion, namely that small mean free path compared to the length of the container can occur even in perfect gases, although perfect gases are gases where you assume that somehow the volume occupied by the molecule is small. But what's going to be important here for rarefaction or not rarefaction of the gas is this notion of mean free path, right? So here we have a situation where the volume occupied by the molecules is small compared to the size of the container, but however, the mean free path is small compared to the size of the container. So we're in a situation where these particles, they meet very often, right? Now, if you keep the same temperature, but if you lower the pressure, then you can very easily arrive at a situation where the degree of rarefaction, namely the mean free path, is going to be the same order of magnitude as the size of the container. And so typically, if you lower the pressure at 10 to the minus 4 atmosphere, then you would get a mean free path which is comparable, which is of the order of 1 centimeter. And this situation here is the situation where kinetic theory would typically apply, whereas the above situation is a situation where you would like to apply the equation of continuum mechanics, gas dynamics. So the important parameter that measures this notion of rarefaction is the Knudsen number, which is the ratio of the mean free path to the macroscopic length scale, the typically the size of the container of the or the length of observation, say. Now, so as I said, because we're trying to understand the transition between kinetic and fluid regimes. Fluid regimes are those that are characterized by a small Knudsen number, and this implies that because you have many collisions per unit time, the gas is in local thermodynamic equilibrium, and its state is adequately described by a few parameters. And for a perfect gas, typically it's going to be the pressure, the temperature, and the velocity field. At variance, kinetic regimes are characterized by the fact that the Knudsen number is of order 1, and since the gas is more rarefied, there are not enough collisions per unit of time for a local thermodynamic equilibrium to be reached, and therefore you cannot describe the state of the gas by these parameters, the pressure, the temperature, and the velocity field. You need more information to describe the gas. But however, because the packed volume of the molecules is small, I mean the excluded volume is small, then you can assume somehow that correlations between particles are weak. And therefore, to describe the state of the gas, you don't need to go to the n-body phase space, which will be enormous, right? You just need to work in the single particle phase space, and the state of the gas when the Knudsen is of order 1 is adequately described by the single particle phase space density, which is a function f of time, position, and velocity, which if you want is the density of particles or molecules which at time t are in the position x and move with velocity v. All right. So now you see you have two kinds of quantities, right? So for the fluid regime, you have the pressure, the temperature, velocity field, or the density, the macroscopic density, which is the same as giving the pressure. Whereas, so these are a few functions of T and X, and here you have a single function of T, X, and V. And then you have to, you'd better understand how you pass from this description to this one if you want to understand the transition from kinetic to fluid regimes. All right, so this is done in the following way. So it's, you know, pretty much as you do in quantum mechanics. It's the same kind of thing. You know, you describe macroscopic quantities, observables, in the following manner. You take whichever quantity you want to compute for a single particle. Suppose that you want to compute the momentum, for instance. So the momentum for a single particle will be mv, where m is the mass of the particle and v is the velocity. And you average mv under the measure f of t, x, and v, dx, dv, under the phase space density. And then you get a momentum, you get a quantity that depends on t alone, which is the momentum of the gas in your container. You can do likewise for the energy. Okay, so you take the kinetic energy of each particle and you average with respect to the phase space density, and this gives you the total energy of the gas in your container. So here I've averaged with respect to X and V, but of course you can also define macroscopic densities with respect to the Lebesgue measure. So you can define a momentum density. That is, here you simply do not integrate with respect to X. And momentum density, there is one integral too much. You average mv with respect to dv, to f dv only, and you get a momentum density which is a function of t and x, right? Which would be typically rho times u of t and x, where rho is the macroscopic density and u the velocity field, right? So you get a function of t and x, and these macroscopic densities are typically the objects which you want to prove that they solve the equation for continuum dynamics. Okay? Good. So now let's come to let's come to the main object in kinetic theory, which is the Boltzmann equation itself. So, so far I've described the number density or the single particle phase space density, and now I'm going to describe the equation that governs this this number density, the evolution of this number density. So this number density is governed by the Boltzmann equation, which is written here. So you see that this equation comes in two pieces. So you have I think I need a pointer. Okay. So you have the left-hand side of the equation like this, which is a free streaming of particles. And on the right-hand side, you have something which is usually called the collision integral. So let me describe briefly what both objects mean. All right, so the left-hand side of this equation describes simply the fact that between two collisions, particles propagate on straight lines. In other words, they have a constant velocity. So that's a free streaming, okay? So in other words, I'm considering here particles without external force, such as gravity or electric field, if there were ions or anything of the sort, right? So these are free particles, and the only thing that's gonna change the velocity of the particles is collision between particles. All right, so the collision between particles is described by this part of the equation, and because of rarefaction effect, you will neglect, or the Boltzmann description neglects collisions other than binary. Only the binary collisions are considered in this equation, or considered by this term here. And actually, if you try to take into account more than binary collisions, then it becomes really complicated. And there is, I don't know of any conditions on orders of magnitude. I don't know of any limit where you would consider, for instance, triple collisions and not higher order collisions, right? So binary collisions are really special in this business, and they correspond to neglecting other than binary collisions correspond to the fact that that you're in the perfect gas regime because of the rarefaction. There is another fact which is important, which should be remembered, which is at the kinetic level of description, the size of the particles, the radius or the diameter of the particles, is neglected everywhere. You will not see it anywhere in the equation, except in the mean free path, which is an order of magnitude that will somehow appear in this collision integral here. Okay? So, except for the appearance of that factor, that mean free path that pops out of the collision integral, the collision process is purely local and instantaneous. So if you want, it's local in space and time. And so if you want, you have collision between material points. The radius of the particles is essentially taken to be zero. And that explains why this collision integral B of FF, it operates only on the V variable in the function F, and T and X here are just parameters, okay? All right, so now let me write the collision integral. So that's a pretty complicated object. I'm writing it in the simplest of all cases, namely the case where the particles are considered as hard spheres. Right? So you think of an assembly of hard spheres undergoing elastic collisions, and that's it. Right? And you neglect collisions other than binary. All right. So for a gas of hard spheres with radius r, in the limit where r is small, the Boltzmann collision integral is written in this way. Okay, so it's an integral. It's an integral where V is given. So remember that the B of FF should be evaluated at any time, position, and velocity. But as I said, time and position can be considered as parameters here. So you just compute it for a given velocity, right? So you give a velocity V, and you want to compute the collision integral at that velocity V. So what you do is, this collision integral is going to be an integral over a five-fold dimensional space, so it depends on another velocity V star and on a direction omega. So omega runs through the unit sphere, and V star runs through R3, and what you, and the integrand is this quantity here, so it's f of V prime star minus f of V star, multiplied by this factor here, and the V prime and the V prime star are defined in terms of V, V star, and omega by these formulas here. Okay, so it's a bit complicated, but what you end up with is an integrand here that is a function of V star and omega, and the dependence of this integrand through V star and omega, in V star and omega, is given through the formula giving V prime and V prime star in terms of V star, V, and omega, right? Before going further, let me mention the usual notation that we will encounter everywhere in the business, that F star stands for F of V star, and F prime star stand for respectively F of V prime and F of V prime star. Now be careful in this business, F prime never designates a derivative, right? So maybe you might think it's a pretty bad notation, however it's been sanctified by more than one century of usage, so it's really hard to change it, okay? Good, so F prime is, I mean, the thing that you have to remember is that F prime is not a derivative, okay? And maybe this complicated integral, but actually it's pretty hard to remember. Actually, I think that when I started working in the Boltzmann equation, it took me a very long time before I became familiar with it. Sorry? Yeah, I'm coming to this. All right, so now you know you have you have this relation that may look a bit mysterious. Now let me try to explain what they represent really. So we want to understand the pre to post collision relations, right? So this collision integral is supposed to model collisions, binary collisions, binary elastic collisions between point particles, right? So we better understand how this works. So if you take any pair of particles that are going to collide, so essentially you describe this pair by, you take any velocity pair, so any V and V star in R sex, and you consider the following relation. So if you call V and V star the velocity of the particles before collision, and V prime star the velocity of the particles after collision, or vice versa, actually, because this is a purely symmetric relation. So here you have the conservation of momentum for particles of equal mass. It tells you that the total momentum of the system of two particles before and after collision are equal. And because you're dealing with elastic collisions, then you have conservation of the kinetic energy before and after collisions are equal. Okay? So this is a set of four equations where if you want, V and V star are given, and the unknowns are V prime star. So this is a set of four equations for six unknowns. So you have two free parameters, and this explains the appearance of the omega, which is a unit vector, therefore two parameters. And if you actually solve for V prime and V prime star, if you solve this system in terms of V and V star, then you'll find out that up to an arbitrary unit vector, which you call omega, then the V prime and V prime star are given in terms of V and V star by these formulas, which I gave you on the previous slide. Okay? So that's what the V prime and the V prime star are in terms of V, V star, and omega. I mean, it's really the relation between it's the relation of pre to post collision velocities. And if you want to see the geometric interpretation of these formulas, then you have to think about these collisions in the reference frame of the center of mass for the particle pair. So because you have equal masses before and after collision, you have two opposite vectors, and the only unknown is just the direction of just the angle, if you want, between these between the vectors before and after collision, right? So the picture is like this. So here is the center of mass. Here are the V and V star, so they're opposite vectors, before and after collision. So, the V prime and V prime star are given like this, and the omega is such that you pass from this vector to this one by the symmetry with respect to the plane which is perpendicular to omega, right? So if you want omega as the external bisector of the vector V star V and V prime star V prime. Okay? So that's what these collision relations are. Now, once you have this beautiful collision integral, it's important to understand a little bit that it has some important. Yeah, it's a good question, actually. All right, so here, if you look at this formula here, you see that if you change omega into minus omega, you don't change anything, right? So in this integral here, it doesn't matter really whether you integrate over the whole sphere or over half the sphere. Now, it's just going to change the integral by a factor of one half. So, but you're right. I mean, the natural parameter was the omega should not be the unit sphere, but the projective whatever. Right.
Didn't you say in the slide before this one that only the mean three
paths are coming to both centers? Right, and actually, the way you see it here is the mean free path appears very naturally in terms of the radius here. So if you want, all I meant is that the radius of the molecules does not appear in the relation between V, V star, and V prime star. If you think of collision between objects that have a shape, right, typically between spheres, then the omega would not be a random vector over which you integrate as here, right? If you think of collision between spheres that have a non-zero radius, then if you know the incoming velocity is, and if you know where they touch, the outgoing velocities are completely determined, right? And the omega for spheres with a radius would be typically the unit vector that join both centers of the molecules at the time of the collision. The fact is that at the scale where the Boltzmann equation applies, the radius is negligible compared to the other length scales, and therefore you lose the fact that this unit vector is well determined before the collision. So you integrate so that this unit vector becomes a random parameter, and you average over this omega, right? So it's important because the fact that the radius is taken to be zero is one of the sources of irreversibility in this equation, right? So that's an important fact, right?
I should just remark that you've written the equation in kind of a dimensional way. And when you actually derive it, you derive it in non-dimensional way. And in fact, the R squared that you see here is actually divided by M, the mass of the molecule, which is also going to zero. So in the non-dimensional way, you see it's not only the non-dimensional parameter, which is only one, appears in the equation. It's just that it's been unfolded into the dimensional form again that makes it look like he's violating what he said earlier.
No, all I see, yeah,
it's
really.
More clear in the notes.
Right. No, but actually, it's going to be should be more clear a few graphs from now. I hope. All I really want to say is that you have this mean free path, which you will see depends only on the radius of the molecules. And the, okay, so this radius will come out of the integral, and with other quantities, so as to make the Knudsen number appear. And what remains inside the integrals, the specifics, the rule of the collision does not depend on R, right? It's purely local and instantaneous, okay? All right, so geometric interpretation. Now let's come to the symmetry of the collision integral. All right, so here I've taken R equal to 1 because so as to just explain the mathematics. There's perhaps one of the most important facts about the Boltzmann collision integral, which is the following symmetry. So you see that the first observation is that if I integrate this collision integral, which is a function of V, if I integrate it against another test function phi of V, then I get this triple integral here, and as you may observe from the formulas, this expression here is purely symmetric, is really symmetric in the star and unstar variables, and so is this expression here, and therefore this triple integral here is equal to that same quantity here, except that you integrate against phi plus v star over 2. Now that's the first obvious symmetry. The fact that the star and unstar variables are completely identical. Now, there's another important symmetry, perhaps the most important, which is what happens if you change the prime into the n prime variables here. So you want to change v prime and v prime star into v and v star and vice versa. Okay, so let's examine what happens if you do so. If you remember the formula that gives you V and V star in terms of V prime and V prime star, if you think of it in the center of mass reference frame, this is a symmetry. This is an orthogonal symmetry, and therefore it's an involution, right? So it is its own inverse, this transformation. Okay. So you see that if I change the prime variables into the n prime variables and vice versa, then this integrand here changes sign, and now I should explain what happens with this quantity here. Now, because this transformation from VV star to V prime star is an orthogonal symmetry, so it's an isometry of R sex. Well, as you can really see that this is a conservation of kinetic energy, right? So you have V squared plus V star squared is equal to V prime squared plus V prime star squared. So you really have an isometry of R6, and therefore you preserve this transformation for any given omega preserves the Lebesgue measure of R6, namely dV dV star is equal to dV prime dV prime star. Okay? And if you look at the formulas here, V minus V star omega is equal to minus V prime star omega. But because you have an absolute value here, you don't change the factor, okay? So, sorry? The radius in which formula? Yeah, as I said, I've taken R equal to 1. It's simply a factor, so you can take it out of the integral. It's not going to change anything to what I'm saying. Okay, so I've taken it equal to 1 for simplicity here. What's important is that it's not entering this formula of V prime star, the collision formula. It's really the fact that it's important at this point. Okay, so, alright, so once you've noticed that, then you come up with the following theorem that I've stated for functions that are rapidly decaying at infinity, and you multiply with a phi, which is at most polynomial growth at infinity. Okay, so these are not the most general assumptions, but these are nice assumptions for this to explain the following formula. I mean, actually, you can allow yourself more generality, but I don't want to do that. I don't want to do that in detail now. So what happens is that the collision integral integrated against a function phi. Now, if I go back to the previous formula, to the formula on the previous page, so you have this quantity here, and then what I do, I exchange the prime and the n prime variables. So this is changing to its opposite. This doesn't change, and the phi plus phi star becomes the phi prime plus phi prime star, and therefore, this integral here is obviously equal to the integral that you get there. So you get the integral over the whole space, R3 and S2, when you're integrating dv, dv star, and omega. So you have the usual integrand, f prime star minus ff star, times phi plus phi star minus phi prime star, integrated against this factor here. Now you can actually undo part of what I did here, and you can actually replace this integrand here by just the ff star with just this expression divided by 2. And if you want, you can use this formula here as a definition of this quantity in the sense of distribution. But really, the thing to remember is just the second formula. Okay. This one is also interesting, but I will not use it much during this lecture. Okay, so now that we have this formula, let's try to see its consequences. So now you want to speak of collision invariants. So what are the collision invariants? These are the functions for which whenever you take v star v prime and v prime star related by the pre to post collision formulas, then this expression phi of v plus phi of v star minus phi of v prime minus phi of v prime star is identically equal to zero. Okay. And there's a theorem which says that if you want to solve this, so you can view this as a functional equation for the unknown phi, right? If you want that this be satisfied for all v star and omega, and any collision invariant, there's a theorem that says that any collision invariant is a linear combination of the constant of the function 1, the constant, plus the component of the velocity vector, so v1, v2, v3, plus v squared. Right? So any collision invariant is of this form, and it's obvious that if you take a function of this form, it's a collision invariant, because the fact that 1 is a collision invariant is obvious. It's 1 plus 1 minus 1 minus 1 is equal to 0. And the fact that v is a collision invariant, that any component of v is a collision invariant, follows from the conservation of momentum through binary collisions. And the conservation of kinetic energy, because you have elastic collisions, gives you the fact that the v squared is a collision invariant. So really, the important fact is that the converse is true, that any collision invariant is of this form, and that's really important, because these functions phi are such that if you take any function in L1 that is rapidly decaying, then if you integrate the collision integral against such a collision invariant, then you find identically zero for any f. right? Any density, sure. So V1, V2, V3 are the components. So V is a vector. So V is the first component, V2 is the second, V3 is the third, right? All right, so these relations are important because they're valid for all Fs, right? Yes, because you go back to the formula which is here, and so this is equal to that, okay? And for a collision invariant, this quantity is identically zero by definition. Yes? So you mean if this is zero for all F, does it mean that the phi is a collision invariant? I think so. Yeah, I think so. What? No, I mean, no, it's not the H theorem, but you're considering F as a test function, and this is implied by this formula here, right? You're considering F as a test function, and then this will tell you that phi plus phi star minus phi prime minus phi prime star is identically zero. Okay? Well, I mean, almost everywhere equal to zero, but for this business, the theorem holds true if the relation holds almost everywhere. Okay, so now that I have this formula here, let me use them to derive local conservation laws. Well, so if you take F, which is a solution to the Boltzmann equation that satisfy the assumptions of the theorem, namely that is rapidly decaying in a V variable, then if I integrate the collision integral if I just take the average of the collision integral, I should find zero because one is the collision invariant. Same if I integrate V against any component of the velocity vector V. And same if I integrate it with against 1/2 of V squared. So in all these integrals here are equal to zero. So it gives me five local conservation laws, which are written here. Right. So the first one is d by dt of the integral of f dv plus the divergence of the integral of vf dv. So that's the local conservation of mass, or if you want, it's the continuity equation. The second one, so you multiply the streaming operator by V, so that gives you d by dt of the integral of Vf plus the divergence of the tensor integral of V tan squared F equals zero. That's the local conservation of momentum. And the last one, d by dt of the integral of V squared F plus the divergence of V times V squared F equals zero, which is the local conservation of energy. Now these, if you look at this, these three relations here, now this looks promising because they really look like local conservation laws, like what you get in continuum mechanics, and really understanding how you pass from the Boltzmann equation to hydrodynamic models really consists in working on this local conservation laws for the Boltzmann equation and understanding what they become in the limit of the Knudsen number going to zero if you wanted a mean free pass, small mean free pass limit. Yes.
Your statements with F were with F in one.
Was rapidly decaying, rapidly decaying. Sure. F is positive in this business.
It's
it's always implicit. It's a density. Absolutely. Well, as a matter of fact, it's not clear that you can construct solutions to the Boltzmann equation which satisfy the assumption that they're rapidly decaying in a V variable. Right? It's not clear. What? Yeah, I mean, it's actually in certain conditions you can prove that such a thing exists. But let me just mention that these relations are assumed to hold under much more general conditions. Now let me come to a second consequence of the symmetries of the collision integral in the following way. So if you suppose that you take a positive f, which is rapidly decaying, and assume that the log of f has a polynomial growth at infinity. If you do so, then you can use as the function phi here, you can use the log of f itself, right? So I'm going to compute this integral here with phi being the log of f. So if you do that, then you get the log of f in this expression here, and the properties of the log tell you that this expression becomes this, right? So the integral of b of f times the log of f is equal to minus 1/4 the integral over all variables of f prime star minus f star times the log of f prime star divided by f star, right? And because the log is an increasing function, this quantity here is non-negative, and therefore the integral here is less than or equal to zero. Okay. More is true is that if this integral is equal to zero, then it's equivalent to the fact that the b of fs is equal to zero everywhere, almost everywhere, and this itself is equivalent to the fact that f is a Maxwellian. And saying that f is a Maxwellian means that capital F of v is of the following form. So if you want, it's a Gaussian distribution velocity, where the mean velocity is u. So it's a vector in R3. The covariance matrix is theta times identity. So here you have the theta, which plays the role of the temperature. Physically, that's what it means. So u is the mean velocity, theta is the temperature, and because this is not a probability, you have a density rho, which is not necessarily equal to 1. All right. So I will always use this notation m of rho u theta of v to designate the Maxwellian with density rho, temperature theta, and mean velocity u. Okay. And these are the functions, these are the densities for which the collision integral is equal to zero. Now, what are the implications of conservation laws plus H theorem? Now, if you just work with the conservation laws, then you found the conservation of mass, the local conservation of mass, momentum, and energy. But if you add the H theorem, then you see that the integral of this quantity here has a sign, and if I multiply the Boltzmann equation by log of f, then I find an additional relation that says that d by dt of the integral of f log of f plus the divergence of vf log of f is less than or equal to zero. And for those of you who are familiar with the theory of conservation laws, then this you can think of this last differential inequality, which bears on the entropy density, as analogous to the Lax-Friedrichs entropy condition that selects admissible solution when there are shocks in a hyperbolic system of conservation laws. Right. So this is, if you want the Lax-Friedrichs entropy condition on hyperbolic systems, it's a generalization of this differential inequality here. However, if you're in a condition when there are no shocks for the Euler equations, then you know that entropy is conserved. This is not in contradiction here, because in the limit where the Euler equation actually is valid, then this right-hand side, which has a sign here, is going to be identically equal to zero because you have a Maxwellian distribution because you have local thermodynamic equilibrium, right? So let me come to the dimensionless form of the Boltzmann equation and the scaling that leads to the compressible Euler. Okay, so far as they've noticed, I've written the Boltzmann equation keeping the physical quantities, right? Except I set the mass equal to 1, but maybe also the Boltzmann constant equal to 1. But apart from this, the radius of the molecules will still there. Okay. So now I want to write the dimensionless form of the Boltzmann equation, and I want to make appear the Knudsen number in the equation, particular. So I'm going to choose macroscopic scales of time, capital T, and length, capital L, and a reference temperature, theta. And this defines two velocity scales in the following manner. First, you have a velocity scale, which is capital L over T. If you want, that's the macroscopic velocity, which you observe, because as a consequence of the fact that your observation length and the observation time are capital L and capital T. But there's another velocity which you can construct with these data. Typically, for particles with mass 1, you take the square root of theta, right? So theta is an energy, right? I take the Boltzmann constant equal to 1, so you can think of theta as being an energy. So if you take the square root of theta, this is really going to be a speed, right? It has the dimension of a speed. So this square root of theta is, if you want, the thermal speed. And finally, I set n, script n, to be the total number of particles. Right? So then with this, you define dimensionless time, position, and velocity variables in the following manner. So dimensionless time and space is easy. Notice that the velocity of the particles, I will take the dimensionless velocity variable by dividing the velocity by the thermal speed and not by this macroscopic velocity, right? This is essential. So the velocity of the individual particle is going to be given in terms of this thermal speed C. And with this, you define the dimensionless number density by this formula here, right? Okay, if you do that, you stuff that in the equation, then you get this object here, and observe that the radius of the molecules that was here pops out and comes here in front. And okay, so if I look at the prefactor multiplying the collision integral, then it's nr squared over L squared, so you can view this as capital L times nr squared over L cubed, and nr squared over L cubed, it's really L divided by, so you have the L here, so it's 1 over the mean free path times pi. Well, pi comes because pi r squared is really the section of the molecule, right? Right. So apart from this innocuous factor of pi, this quantity here is the ratio of L to the mean free path computed with the recipe of the first slide, right? So what you get here is 1 over pi times the Knudsen number. Good. So the Knudsen number appears in front of the collision integral. And whatever is inside the integral thereafter is dimensionless. Now, there you have this number here. And this number here, you see, it's a frequency times a length divided by C. And by analogy, let's call this a kinetic swirl number. Okay. So the dimensionless form of the Boltzmann equation is given here. So you have swirl times d by dt of f plus v d by dx of f as 1 over Knudsen times pi times the dimensionless collision integral. Good. So now what's the compressible Euler scaling? So you get compressible Euler from the Boltzmann equation by assuming, by taking the following assumption. You assume that the Struhl number is you set it to 1, and you set the pi times the Knudsen number, if you want the Knudsen number, to be of order epsilon. So Struhl of order 1, Knudsen of order epsilon, and you end up with this scale Boltzmann equation here, where is epsilon small. And because the 1 over epsilon is in front of the collision integral here, then you expect that as epsilon tends to 0, then this quantity here, the unscaled collision integral, should converge to 0. And of course, if you assume that f epsilon converges to f, then b of ff is equal to 0. But that means that f of tx and z is a Maxwellian for all t and x, meaning that to leading order, therefore the limit f of tx and z is of this form. So it's a Maxwellian in the velocity v, and the parameters of that Maxwellian are functions rho, u, and theta, which depend on t and x. So that's what you mean by a local equilibrium. You know, it has the shape of an equilibrium as a function of v, but the parameters of this equilibrium may depend on t and x. So that equilibrium is not uniform, it's not absolute in the sense that it may vary in time and space. And now the problem is to find the governing equations for rho, u, and theta. Well, then. Let me go directly to the local conservation laws. Well, if you remember, we had seen before that for all solutions of the Boltzmann equation that have rapid decay at infinity in V, we had this three local conservation laws plus this differential inequality for the entropy, right? So once you know that the limiting f as epsilon tends to 0 is a local Maxwellian, then the thing to do is to replace f with this local Maxwellian in this five conservation laws. So it's two scalar conservation law plus one plus a vector conservation law, because it's a conservation of momentum. So if you do that, you get these conservation laws here, and when you express, when you compute these all these quantities here, then you find that these are the Euler equations for rho, u, and theta, the Euler equation of gas dynamics for rho, u, theta, and the differential inequality here gives you the fact that the entropy increases when you cross shockwave. I mean, it's the Lax-Friedrichs entropy inequality, right? So I've given here the formulas for the moment of a Maxwellian. So the integral of m is equal to rho, the integral of vm is rho u, the integral of v 10 squared m is rho u 10 squared plus theta times identity. So when you take the trace of this tensor here, you get this quantity here, which is the total energy. So you have the kinetic energy and the internal energy. Here's the energy flux. So if you substitute these quantities inside of the conservation laws here, then you'll find the compressible Euler equations, right? And likewise, if you compute the entropy and the entropy flux, these formulas here, when you substitute them into this differential inequality here, will give you the fact that the entropy increases when you cross shockwaves. Okay, so maybe let me just say a few words. You see what I told you is you just take the F epsilon, you pass through the limit in the conservation laws, and that's it. Now, really, the only thing that you, so this is a, if you want, this is a formal result. I mean, I don't have any proof of the, I don't have any rigorous proof that the derivation of compressible Euler from the Boltzmann equation, because in the first place, if such a thing was available, that would give global solution of compressible Euler, and that would be certainly a great achievement. Okay, so I mean, there is no this time it's not known whether the Cauchy problem for compressible Euler is well posed for arbitrary initial data. I mean, all is known is in one dimension for initial data that have small variation. And this is a result that goes back to Gleam and Typing U, right? However, the only thing that that you have to assume in this derivation is that F epsilon is has enough decay in velocity with log of F that has polynomial growth at most for large Vs. And that will be for all epsilon. You don't need that to be uniform in epsilon. The big assumption will be that F epsilon converges pointwise to F. Once you know this, then essentially the H theorem gives you that the limit has to be Maxwellian, and you can the rest of the proof unfolds. You know, you don't have to assume anything more. But really, the thing that is missing is the fact that F epsilon converges to F pointwise, okay? Plus some estimates on the decay in velocity. This, if you want, in mathematical language, this is what is missing is a compactness theorem, right? The fact that you have pointwise convergence. The only thing that is known at the moment are bounds, right? So from bounds in function spaces, you can usually infer weak compactness result, but not strong compactness that would imply pointwise convergence. Okay, so that's really what is the thing that is missing to make this argument that I showed you a proof. Okay, so that's a type of limit that does not work for the compressible Euler, but we shall see that it works for other hydrodynamic limits. That being said, I will stop here. Thank you.